Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Last week, I mentioned how the Elie Wiesel image-making machine has turned out a documentary film presenting Elie as an iconic figure, even of the caliber of Jesus Christ. The film is titled In the Footsteps of Elie Wiesel and follows 12 high school students who were recruited and sent to Europe to first visit Elie's birthplace in Sighet, Romania, then move on to Auschwitz-Birkenau, where he was allegedly deported and interned for 8 months, then to Versailles, France, where Elie was sent as a 16-year-old orphan, again allegedly, from the Buchenwald camp in mid-1945. You can read all about this at my website, www.carolynyeager.com. Fortunately, we, the truth seekers who are opposing the myth makers, have been busy also. We aren't just sitting around and grumbling about what those who own the media are doing. We have been talking and organizing based on the excellent work of revisionists, and in this case, special notice goes to the indefatigable Carlo Mattonio, and are now putting together a website that will challenge all of Elie Wiesel's allegations and show where they have come from and how they have grown and evolved since the book Night was first published. An article announcing our effort, written by yours truly, will appear in July, within the next few days, Smith's Report, a newsletter published by Bradley Smith, who is director of the Committee for Open Debate of the Holocaust, or CODO, that's in capital letters, C-O-D-O-H is how it is better known. You can find CODO on the internet at www.codoh.com. Once this newsletter is available at CODO, it will be widely distributed to draw attention to our project. And I hope all you listening will help to disseminate this article and, of course, to participate in the website, which will follow shortly. I don't think I need to tell you that we don't need just hundreds, ladies and gentlemen. We need millions to bring about the downfall of this icon. And I'm not talking about dollars. Although maybe that would do it. I'm talking about people. And it will be fun, I promise you. So, on to the main program. I am hung up on concentration camp lore, I admit. There is so much written and said about them, what you might call big fish tales, where they get bigger and bigger in the telling, that I am determined to bring them back down to size, or to do what I can. As you know, I have written a small book about Auschwitz-Birkenau titled The Underground Guided Tour, What the Tour Guides Don't Tell You at Auschwitz-Birkenau. It's available for only $10 by calling toll-free 877-773-9077, charging it your credit or debit card, and it will be mailed to your door. No extra charges. What could be easier? I'm going to refer to this book tonight as I ask even more questions of Dr. Wilhelm Crissmann about the British-run camps he was detained in after the war. Even though he has told us about these camps in two previous appearances on the Heretics Hour, on June 14th and March 15th, there's still more to learn. So we'll begin with that. Welcome, Dr. Crissmann. Once again, I'm very happy to be speaking with you tonight.
Hello, Ms. Yeager. Glad to be with you again.
Well, since I have you here as an eyewitness and survivor of Wolfsburg and Wetzelsdorf, you probably have never called yourself a survivor, but of course we know that those who were interned in Nazi camp certainly call themselves survivors, and I call you a survivor. Because I know that I am going to take a much harder tone on this than you have done and probably are prepared to do. And you have agreed to allow me to do that, so we'll just continue here. I want to compare these British-run detention camps with Auschwitz, the German camp that I know the most about, that has been written about the most, and that is considered the very worst of all. In fact, it is considered an extermination camp where most of those who were sent there to be killed. So this is quite a comparison we're going to make, but I think it's going to work out very well. So let's start with some basic facts. In my book, I tell the readers that Auschwitz began as a POW camp in April 1940. Now, there was also a British POW camp built later on the periphery of the IG Farben factory near where the Monowitz camp was, which is also in the Auschwitz complex. So we've got Auschwitz, of course, became a concentration camp in 1942. I'm sure that the Brits were not in barracks holding 100 or 1,000 men each, but were housed in smaller units like you were. But anyway, now I want you to begin, if you will, please, to tell us about the Wolfsburg barracks, what they were like, how it was built, the size, and you can also include Wetzelsdorf in that, too, if there was much difference there between the two of them. So would you please do that? Dr. Christman.
Well, both of them, Wolfsburg and Wetzelsdorf, were originally built by the German Wehrmacht as prisoner of war camps for British and American prisoners. They were well-built barracks with all accommodations, Wolfsburg much bigger than Wetzelsdorf, and after the end of the war, the Brits used both of them as detention camps for political internees, and one of them I was there. I was delivered, so to speak, to the camp second week of December 1945, September I said, not in, and at that time there were already close to 4,000 detainees in the camp. Big camp with about five blocks, what they called, and within the blocks there were about 8 to 10 barracks, and the barracks contained average between 8 and 12 people. They were well built, they were all utilities there, wood stoves. We had straw sets as mattresses, we had kind of linen, we had light. And then each block had also sanitary utilities. Each barracks contained about, I think, about 4 to 5, maybe up to 7 or 8 rooms. And in each room, there were 8 to, in my room, I know we were 9 people, all known to me and then from my valley. And we had.
How big were these rooms? How big was the room that you had 9 people in?
Well, it was big enough that we had chairs and table to sit there, read there, and have our breakfast and lunch and dinner. We had, after it was issued in the open field in the block, we ate in our rooms, and they were big enough to move around, to sit down, to read.
The bed was, were they bunk beds?
They were wooden beds and stacked
but
up.
But were they bunk beds? Yeah, stacked up bunk beds?
Yeah.
How high?
Wooden boards and just one above another. I mean, for instance, I was sleeping on top of my father in the low bed, and that was only stacked one upon another.
Okay, well, you know, the red brick barracks at Auschwitz, there were 28 of them, and they weren't all used for living spaces. They were used for other, they were infirmaries and other things too. But we don't know what they were like inside. Some of them today are used as for museum space, and the rest you can't go into. The only one they allow you to go into is what they call the cell block, the punishment block. And they have windows all along. They're very nice looking buildings, you know. And they probably, I would think, were divided also inside. I don't think that they were just inside, just rows and rows of beds like they show in some of these pictures at Birkenau. But they did have bunk beds with mattresses. And you said you had...
We had bunk beds with straw mattresses and then some coarse linen.
Uh-huh. And did you have, like, sheets over you and blankets and things like that?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And at Auschwitz, there were flush toilets. What kind of facilities did you have there? Did you have flush toilets?
We had toilets. I do not remember if they were flush, but the sanitary accommodations were there for the whole block, not in each barrack, but there were separate sanitary. It was kind of utility hut.
Okay, so you didn't have your own in for your own nine people in your own section there. You
no.
had the toilets and sinks and so on were for everyone in a separate building?
In a separate kind of a hut, yes, within the block.
Within the large block?
You know, there were about six large blocks, and in each block there were quite a few barracks, all between 8 and 12 barracks, and each block was separated and separated by a fence, so you couldn't move from mm-hmm. one block to another, or you could only move with a kind of permission slip, which was issued by the German leader of the Lager. You know, there mm-hmm. were two German or Austrian Lager Führers, we called them, and I still remember. The one was Dr. Wick, the executive chief of a big magnesite factory, and the other one was Dr. Burger, a lawyer from Klagenfurt. And they were really, and each block had his own responsible leader too, and we were called to a roll call in the morning and the evening, and British sergeants or officers checked us out.
Yes, so you had a roll call every morning and every evening, and you
Correct.
Had to line up outside, and they
Yes.
called off, did they call off your numbers or what?
Yes, they called up the names, and we stood in a row, like a military unit.
Yeah, and they call up, did they call you, did they refer to you by number or by name?
No, by name. We didn't have any.
Yeah, and these were your own people. Who were
yes.
the leaders here? Yes,
yeah.
And so
a British either sergeant or officers.
How many windows were in your separate section that you eight or nine were in?
Oh, in our barracks. Well, I do not correctly remember the numbers, but I think it were at least four windows. I think there was enough light during day to come in, and there were electrical lamps there, and the light turn off was every...
You had electricity?
Yes, we did.
Okay. Well, you know, this is like typical, to me, this is typical German-built barracks for camps.
Oh, yes.
It's not, it's a very much the same. Now, were these built, was this camp built after the Anschluss? Was it built when Austria was part of Germany, or what would you say?
Well, pretty sure it was built after the Anschluss. I suspicion that it might have been originally built for the Reichsarbeitsdienst, but I'm not sure about that, just speculation on my part. But I was able to talk to the last commander of the Wolfsburg camp. It was an Austrian major with the name of Kuritz and lived in Graz. And he didn't tell me when they built it, but he was commanding the camp, which was specially for British and American prisoners.
Okay. So was the Wetzelsdorf camp, even though it was a much smaller camp, was the building similar and the whole situation similar?
Wetzelsdorf was much, much smaller, yes. I don't think we were more than maybe between 500 and 800, and in the center there was also a small barrack with about 30 to 40 women, ladies.
Mm-hmm. But the accommodations there were basically the same?
They were similar. The rooms were smaller. We were in my room. We were just 5 people.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on. What about shaving? You know, you were allowed to have razors and all of that stuff. And
Yes.
Yeah. You had what you brought with you. Now, how did you get anything more after you got there? Was there a store there like there were in all of the...
No, it was not a store. We were allowed to write once a month a letter that was a pre-lined piece of paper, and the words were limited, and we were also allowed to receive once a month a small food package and necessities for your either shaving or soap or toothbrush and so on.
So you had to get that from your relatives.
And you can
only get that once a month. So you had to be sure that you asked for those things and that they...
We were allowed to receive books. Also a limited amount, also once a month. There was no library in the camp.
Okay. So I was going to ask you, I doubted that there was. All Nazi camps had libraries. And I would think prisoner of war camps were supposed to be better than concentration camps. But you think that there was a library there and they removed it when the Allies took over?
That I don't know.
Right.
But I know there was no library, but we were allowed to get books from our families on our monthly shipments, which were primarily little food package and then sanitary necessities.
And were they able to send you money? Were you able to have money, or there was just nothing to buy with any money?
Well, there was nothing to buy, and we didn't need any money.
Okay. Well, they did have money. The Jews and all the others had complained so much. They did get money. They were able to receive money, and they did have things to buy in those camps. So they could also get subscribed to a newspaper. Were you able to have any newspapers?
No. Well, if you demanded newspapers from your family, you probably could have gotten it. But I do not. I only remember that I was reading English newspapers when I was called up to clean the sergeant's room, and he was nice enough, since he knew that I was very thoroughly studying English language. I read newspapers in his room.
All right, so, but you were not able to subscribe. If your family sent you a newspaper, it would have been an old one, right? I mean, they couldn't send you a subscription. You didn't have the mail. See, at Auschwitz they could get, and Birkenau too, and I'm sure at Monowitz they could subscribe through the post office and receive a newspaper in the mail. Okay.
No, there was no way there to do that, and even
yes.
No interest.
Okay, now what about your clothing? What kind of clothes did you wear? And did you have a locker in your barrack for your personal to keep your personal items?
Yes, we had a small kind of a locker where we had our clothes, limited clothes. We were wearing our civilian clothes.
Yes, you had the clothes you arrived in, right?
That's
and
right.
And what?
And
how
then spare clothes, spare shirts, underwear, and...
Where did that come from?
One from my family.
Okay, so they sent you clothing too, and you were wearing your own clothing.
I was short in clothing, but then I get some spare and extra clothing, and we were able... It was just limited just enough to change it from time to time. And then we were able to wash our clothes too, so there were no internee uniforms, so to speak.
So everything came from you. They didn't supply anything, did they? They supplied you with nothing except your daily food, which we'll get to.
Daily food, yes. And then there was a medical staff. There were internee doctors available, and if there were some serious cases, they were then transferred to the hospital in Wolfsburg.
Okay, all right, we'll get to that. I want to compare that too. I want to talk about the labor. You know, we know how the labor worked at Auschwitz and the other camps. So you did some hard labor. You said you worked both in the coal pit and as a lumberjack. So what kind of clothing did you wear?
Well, our usual clothing. If you from both back out, there was only one working place, and that those were the forests. Well, about 1.5 outside from Wolfsberg, it was called the Griffner Mountain. And that was lumberjacking, no other word. And that was considered to be a privilege because you got more food, you got even some cigarettes, and you were able to meet relatives at the site of the mountain there. And
yeah, well, if your relatives could afford to travel, as your poor mother had to do, to go there to see you, they didn't bring them. And didn't your clothes wear out from that kind of work? I mean, and so you had, your relatives had to.
No, it was not worn out.
What about heavy shoes? I mean, don't you need to wear heavy shoes when you're out?
We had our own shoes.
You probably had your military boots or something, huh?
I don't remember, but I think I had my own shoes, not military boots, because, well, I could have done it, but I don't know. But I remember not having any problems with clothing or with shoes.
Well, what about the people who didn't work? What did they do all day?
Well, there was a very extensive program of learning languages. There were courses by professors, inmate professors, in English, French, Russian, and Slovenian, I know. I mean, I started taking at least 4 hours a day English lessons by an English professor who was an inmate. And for a short while, I took also up Russians with two or three fellows, but then I quit because I wanted to concentrate on English. There were music lessons, there was an orchestra, there were all kind of games.
And how did the orchestra form itself?
Well, they had a separate barrack, which was for the choir, for the orchestra, and for a group of actors sketching out small plays.
Okay, and I just wanted to tell the listeners that all of this took place at Auschwitz and at Birkenau. There were classes that were put together by the inmates on their own, which is the way yours functioned, right? The British weren't organizing any of this. You just organized it yourselves within your area there. Did you go to classes and activities outside the fence that surrounded your own bunk, or what did you call it, your barracks?
No, there was no chance to go outside the camp, but we could go outside our block. I didn't participate on the choir, neither on the theater group, but the ones who did, like my father was a violinist, he was allowed to go out of our block to the barrack where they had their practicing of the choir and the orchestra.
And where did he get his violin?
Well, he might have gotten his own violin, that I don't know, but he was playing in the orchestra.
Yes, all right. Well, we have to stop now for the break, and we will return, friends, so stay tuned.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, Reports are circulating that the U.S. is amassing a greater military presence in the Middle East. The alleged build-up is also rumored to involve the Israeli use of Saudi Arabian airspace. It's thought by some to be in preparation for an attack on Iran. Paula Sleer can now bring us the latest live from Tel Aviv. So, Paula, tell us who and what are behind these reports.
Well, the reports are that Israeli helicopters dropped off large amounts of military equipment at a Saudi military base in northern Saudi Arabia. They follow on from a report some 2 weeks ago that appeared in the London Times magazine. And according to that report, Riyadh had given permission for Israeli warplanes to use a narrow strip of its airspace in the northern part of the country. The report also states that Riyadh is adjusting its missile defense systems so that Israeli jets flying overhead will not be shot down. Both Jerusalem and Riyadh have denied the reports. Officially, the countries are enemy states, with Riyadh not even recognizing the state of Israel. But having said that, though, there are some who are suggesting there could be some truth in these reports because both countries fear a nuclear Iran and both countries despise the regime in Tehran. There are some also who are suggesting that the reports were leaked by Riyadh as a warning to Tehran that there were more options on the table aside from economic sanctions, while just as many people on the opposite end of the spectrum suggesting that the report could have been leaked by Iran as a warning to Saudi Arabia that it was watching it closely and was not happy with what it was seeing.
Paula, whether or not there is any intention to attack Iran, how do you think Tehran is likely to react to these reports that you're talking about?
Well, there certainly is a buzz of increased military activity around Iran. Right now, the United States has its forces in 10 countries surrounding Tehran. So if the United States did want to attack Iran, it would be in the position to do so. There are American forces in Pakistan, in Afghanistan. We're now hearing from Iranian state television that that American forces have amassed on the Azerbaijan-Iranian border. Now, Azerbaijan has confirmed this, but it says that the American forces are there as a peace keeping mission to deal with armed rebels. At the same time, Washington has also confirmed that a week ago, a fleet of 11 of its warships did sail through the Suez Canal, but it says that this is routine. Tehran, in response, has threatened that in the future it could close the waterway. What people here are worried about is a closer alliance between Turkey and Iran that could shift the balance of power in the region, particularly in light of a possible nuclear Iran, with many Arab capitals expressing concern whether or not the latest round of sanctions against Iran will in fact amount to anything. So there is a lot of concern in the region about these developments, and that is why people here are posturing and putting forward and the possibility of Israel's preparedness for some kind of strike against Iran.
Interesting developments, Paula. We'll come to you for any further information on this developing story. Paula Sleer, live from Tel Aviv. Thank you.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm talking with Dr. Wilhelm Christman about his experience in the Wolfsburg and Wesselsdorf detention camps run by the British after the war. I want to talk now about the food situation. Now, at Auschwitz, there was a very large kitchen, and it had 12 large chimneys because there were 12 large stoves in there. And this was just for the Auschwitz camp. This didn't include Birkenau. There were quite a few. There were like 11 or 12 kitchen buildings at Birkenau. But this one had one large building. And so they did a lot of cooking of some kind, and it had a separate bakery and a butchery, and that means to me that they served meat. Now, there was a special dietary section for hospital and infirmary patients. Now, at Wolfsburg, you told us 2 weeks ago that you got porridge and biscuits in the morning and a pea soup or some kind of rather thin soup, often with bugs, for lunch, and bread and Spam for dinner. You make it sound like you have your nice little table there to eat on and everything. But how were you served? Where were you served? And What were you served in? I want to know, did you have your own utensils? Did they supply them? Or did you have to bring your own bowl and stuff out each time and get it filled up? And also I want to know if the bread and the biscuits were freshly made, and if the Spam came in a container, like a little K-ration, or how was it served?
Well, the food was brought from a central kitchen in kettles to each block and issued there. I think we were supplied by utensils in the camp. I don't think that I carried or had the military German issue of the little conserve box, but it was issued, and also the spoons and knives and forks were available, and we were sitting after it was issued out of the kettles. We went back to our room and ate in our room, or we ate during the summer outside on benches, and all the breakfast, lunch, and dinner also. I remember the porridge was something unusual for us, and we all didn't enjoy it too much, but it was at least nourishing, the soup.
What kind of porridge do you know? I mean, do you know one from another?
I think it was like
wheat farina or something?
No, it was very thick, milky stuff, probably either wheat or, well, it might have been oats, but it was very solid and thick stuff.
And was it salted? I mean, did it have butter in it? I mean, was it seasoned?
No, it was very plain.
Like, no taste, really?
No sweets, no butter. It was watery, but it was solid. It was a thick, milky stuff.
Yeah. Okay, what about the biscuits? Were these biscuits, you know, nice? Oh, did you have butter for your biscuits? Did you have anything to spread on them?
It was really like what we called in German big cakes, you know, thin wafer type.
Oh, English.
Yes.
That's not the kind of food Germans or Austrians like to eat, is it?
No, but that was typically, it very obviously came from British military supplies, I guess.
So did you get as many as you wanted, or did you give
it
to three?
It was strictly rationed. And I remember I gave some to my father because we were all, nobody starved. But we were, at least I and my father, know we were always hungry. The supply from home once a month was very limited because some of our friends who had farmers' background got really good food, and they shared with us.
Yes, you told us about that. But how much can you get from them? And, you know, once a month. So there you were really, you can't say that, well, we got our package and so we ate pretty well. Because that was just like a little treat once a month. No. And then the rest of the time, there you were.
You know,
and this is for men, this is a pretty sad breakfast.
Yeah, well, lunch was pea or beet soup. And the rumor was that it was supplied by the Russian.
Mm-hmm.
There were always bugs, white stuff floating in there, but we didn't mind it because there was. We were told, well, that's additional good vitamins and
vitamins.
Minerals.
No, protein. Protein and bugs, but I don't know about vitamins. Okay, well, you guys were really, you know, you really went along with things without complaining. I can see that. All right, so all you had was this bowl of soup for lunch. Not much to sit down with. No bread with your soup for lunch?
We got again those
crackers.
Kind of, flat cake type of wafers.
Okay. And so then, what about your wonderful Spam dinner?
Well,
what kind of bread was it?
I don't know how many slices we got, but not much.
Okay. And so it was like, how did they slice it? From a big hunk of Spam? Or how was this? Because I know that, I thought that Spam had been developed for the military, for maybe even World War
II. The Spam was originally, I saw it when was in the room of the sergeant. The Spam was originally in tins. And we got it all sliced and rationed.
Okay, and then you got bread with it. Was there any, again, any butter, anything to spread on it? Or
No butter.
God. You know, in the German camp, in the camps of all these Jews and Poles and all gypsies and all who are complaining all the time, they got butter. When they got margarine, they complained that they had to have margarine. You know, they do this to this very day. You know, and they had homemade bread. I mean, they baked in those camps. What kind of bread was this?
Well, again, it was, if there was bread, it was white bread. But most of the time, we got those, about 6 centimeters long, flat wafers, like...
More wafers! Oh, no real bread. So there was no kitchen. They weren't cooking. They weren't baking. They were just having stuff hauled in, right?
I think made out of there must have been a kitchen because the porridge was hot and the soup was hot. So if they had their own curry, I don't know.
But you said the soup was supplied by the Russians, so then they could have just
shipped that in
with big bunches of it, and then they just heated it up there.
Probably.
They didn't actually cook it. Well, this food, I mean, wouldn't you say that's a pretty sad, because the Allies had plenty of food, and the British, you know, the Australians were sending food, the Canadians, they had tons of food. They just didn't want to give it to you because they thought you should be punished. Isn't that correct?
Well, I think you know about the terrible camps in West Germany after the war.
I know. Yes. Well, we're not going to have time to talk about that.
The food there, there was no food at all. So
yeah. You were kept from starving. That's about it. But as far as anything else,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that satisfies me. That's what I thought, and I'm not didn't hear anything better than what I thought. So when you were finished eating, you just returned your bowl they picked up. You didn't have to wash your own food.
I think we did. We had, we had in each block, we had facilities to clean and no water within our room. But there was a washing and sanitary facilities.
Okay, so what you're telling me is that the plates and utensils and so on were in your bunk. Or in your barrack there, and then you took them out, and then afterwards you had to clean them yourself, right?
Yes.
Okay, they didn't serve it in these things, and then, you know, they took them back again and cleaned them themselves. No, you had to do that. Okay. All right. Now, recreation. We know Auschwitz had lots of recreation, and they even had a swimming pool. Now, all camps didn't have swimming pools, but they all had big recreation programs, and they've had soccer playing fields, and well, they had boxing, they had fencing, they had various kinds of things, but mostly soccer was the most popular. Well, did you have anything like that?
There was no swimming pool, there was no soccer field, but there was possibility of playing chess, playing cards, reading, singing.
No sports, though. No sports program.
No active sport, no.
Okay. What about movies? Most of these camps, including Auschwitz, did have a theater, and they showed full-length feature movies. Many of them were German movies, but even if you weren't, a lot of those people could follow them, even if they didn't speak German.
No movies at all. The only thing it was we could attend performances of the choir, or the orchestra.
Of the camp, yes. Well, they could do that in all of these other camps, too, and certainly at Auschwitz and Birkenau. But There can now too. Lots of this was going on and the people attended. So they had plays and even musicals and so on. Now, and of course you did not have a brothel at your camp.
No one.
No. Okay, now the health care. Auschwitz had three whole barracks devoted to infirmaries, plus the SS hospital that inmates were also taken to for surgery and serious things. So, and you said that you had a medical service there.
We had a small infirmary which was staffed by inmate doctors for emergency cases. If there were any serious cases, I assume that they took them out to the hospital in Wolfsburg.
Okay, what do you know about health problems there? Do you know of people getting sick and the detainees getting sick?
Well,
do you know of anybody dying? Would you not really know?
As far as I remember, I think there were one or two people died, but causes I don't know. In our room, there were no serial sicknesses, and then in our block, neither. So.
Well, what about something like a lice problem?
There was no lice and no bug problem at all.
Yes, because the people just didn't have, and the people weren't coming and going a lot either, were they?
No.
Once the people were there to stay.
It was set, and from time to time people were released, but there were no incoming people at all. And all the inmates were primarily from Carinthia and Styria, so all native people, by nature healthy, I guess, and they were all weak, or quite a few were weak because they were undernourished, but there was no typhoid or cholera type of epidemic situation.
No. No, and so were you able to shower every day, or was that not possible?
Well, if you wanted to do it, you did it. I don't know if everybody showered every day.
I understand. All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for going through that with me. Well, Dr. Crispin, I know you recently returned from Europe, and I would like to know what are your major impressions that you could share with us from your time there?
Well, after a week biking in northern Italy between Venice and Mantua, where I had little contact with local people, I spent 5 days in Austria among friends, and there... Well, I was very much interested to find out what the political situation in present Austria is and what kind of problem, if any, the people there are facing. And it was primarily two problems which deeply bothering the people. Number one, immigration. Number two, asylum. And number three, the... importance of the European Union. The immigration problem is serious because they can't apparently can't control the influx of people from the east, from the southeast. They also face a rather large Turkish minority, which turns into a problem where they demand beyond the usual cultural aims of immigrants living in the country. In Vienna, for instance, close to 20% of the people are of Turkish descent. They live in certain districts, concentrated. They have their own stores. They have, they demand their minarets there. They have it in a few places, but they want more. They partly are not cooperative as far as learning the German language is concerned. And there are conflicts between the native people and the Turks. Another serious question is the question of asylums. Also, it's more and more people are coming, fleeing into this country, pretending they are asking for political asylum. They come in with faked names, faked nations, so that it's impossible to return them to any of the original home nations, because the home nation said, we don't know them. Those people are concentrated in asylum homes. They don't work. They cannot work. They are supported financially. And again, that is not too welcomed by the native Austrians and their people.
No. This is one. It's very strange that they come, they lie about who they are. Then, because they don't know where to send them back to, they feel that on humanitarian grounds, they must take care of them.
Well,
they can't just throw them over the border from which they came.
No,
they can't do that. But they should be able to.
And some of them are 2 or 3 years in those asylum homes and supported by the provincial government with everything, but they are not allowed to work. And it's in each of the province there are such asylum homes, and that bothers the people, because they say, well, how come that we should support with our tax money illegal people pretending they are persecuted by their homes, when they really, some of them or most of them, don't come from the country which they assume
they were from. Yeah, well, now, the question I would ask is, why don't these people, these Austrians who don't like this, why don't they vote for the Freedom Party or the other right-wing party, or Strache's party? Why do they keep voting for the Social Democrats who allow all this and encourage it even?
Well, that's not an agenda on the political scene. The votes are party votes. The Social Democrats, the ÖVP and the FPÖ, they don't put this as a program in the elections. So,
but the FPÖ, they're known to be anti-immigrant. They accuse them of being anti-immigrant.
Germany partly tries to solve that, and they have a much larger Turkish population there, and they came out with a law where you have to learn the German language if you want to get a job. And they have schools sponsored and financed by the national budget, so that young Turks children have to go to school.
So they pay, so that again the taxpayers are paying to set up these schools so that these people can learn German. Why do they allow all these people in to begin with?
Well, most of them are already second or third generation Turks.
The first Germans
came in as labor for the automobile industry and the steel industry 20, 30 years ago. Nowadays, even some minor jobs like waiters, like street cleaners and sweepers, Germans or Austrians don't do the work. Those are done by those people, but they
could do the work. Are there not enough Germans and Austrians to do that work? Is that true there? Because not enough.
It's a question. Either not enough, or they don't want to do it.
Well, they could be made to do
because
it. If there's enough of them. That's the question. Is if there really are not enough people to serve? But whatever number of people you have, you should have enough to take care of your own needs. I mean, your needs wouldn't be that great depending on the number that you are. So I don't really buy that. Well, what was the third thing that you,
The third one is the question, do we have enough individual existence and decisions as a republic within the European Union.
Oh.
And here there are different opinions there. The official declaration is very strong pro-European Union. Individual provinces and quite a bit of the public opinion is of other opinion. They think that there are too much restrictions, there are too much strong bureaucracy from Brussels, there's too much dictation. I talked to family members who are in the agricultural business, and they said, well, we really have to do what's coming from Brussels, for instance. Primarily monoculture, as far as raising pigs or raising beef, you can do it what you want. You have to do what it's ordered from the Commissioner of Agriculture in Brussels, and that's what we, there's no way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they do all right, but it seems to me that there is among certain groups of the people unhappiness of being a part of the European Union. As I said, officially, the government is very strong pro-EU.
Yes. Well, all right, Dr. Christman, is there anything else that that's on your mind about your European trip?
Well, I only can say that the economic situation in Austria is healthy. The unemployment is rather low. The cities, villages are clean, it's sour, the people are happy. So I'm very glad that this is one country which economic crisis didn't hit too strong. They are primarily sober and saving and keep their budget in order. There is some deficit budgeting there, naturally. There were some losses amongst the banks involved in East European investments. But overall, the country is in good shape.
All right. Well, and we will leave it at that. I thank you very much for joining me again. It's been a very interesting program for me. And I look forward to your coming on again another time.
Okay,
so that's it for okay.
Nice
thank you. Thank you. And that's it for tonight, friends. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.